Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Philip McKenzie. I'm an anthropologist strategist with a focus on culture and humanity-centered design. I'm Brooklyn-born and Brooklyn-made. Every week, I will bring you guests from a wide variety of backgrounds who, despite their different areas of expertise, share traits in common. They aim high, push boundaries, and make things happen. Their experiences drive insights. On today's episode of The Deep Dive, I'm joined by Norman Wiersbe. Norman is the Gilbert T. Rowe Distinguished Professor of Christian Theology at Duke Divinity School and Senior Fellow at the Kenan Institute for Ethics at Duke University. He is the author and editor of 16 books, including This Sacred Life, Humanity's Place in a Wounded World. He's also most recently published Agrarian Spirit, Cultivating Faith, Community, and the Land. And I have to say, likely the majority of our conversation will land in discussing that latest work, but I'm sure we're going to weave a bunch of stuff together. And I want to welcome Norman to the show. Welcome to The Deep Dive, my friend.
Oh, thanks so much, Philip. Good to be with you.
First of all, my listeners are going to, this is the second time you've been on the show, right? And so what I have to say is that my listeners, several listeners, and I'm not exaggerating this, but quite a few folks.
You mean I didn't mess it up the first time?
You did not mess it up the first time. And several of them all cited how much they love listening to our conversation, our previous conversation.
Oh, that's great.
Not just because of the content of the conversation, but because specifically about your voice.
Oh, my.
Everyone has been like, he's so soothing and calming. It was like,
oh, my goodness.
They're like, it was like listening to like a very thoughtful lullaby.
Can you tell that to my family? I'd love it.
So a lot of folks, when this pops into their inbox or however they listen to the show, they're going to be very, very soothed knowing that we're having another conversation.
Well, I just hope I don't put people to sleep. It's that soothing, right?
No. But it's a thoughtful lullaby.
Like, all right.
I'm serious, man. I got so many notes about like, oh my God, he sounds so peaceful. And I was like,
oh,
absolutely.
Thanks, Phil. That's really lovely of you to say.
We need more peace in our lives, right? Don't we have too many people yelling at each other?
Lord, do we need more peace in our lives? That's for sure.
Absolutely. So these are high compliments. So again, thanks for being on the show. And Agrarian Spirit, you know, as a little bit of a prelude, before we hit the record button, I was sharing with Norman a little bit of how much his work and these types of work mean to me, specifically because I am that quintessential city kid. I grew up in New York, you know, Brooklyn and the land of concrete and glass and tall buildings and all the rest of those things. So I am the furthest thing that one would call from like a naturalist, right? Like I don't know how to do anything but shop.
All right.
And so when I read these books, they really do awaken something in me, a deeper interest to understand more of the natural world, to be more part of it, all that good stuff. So starting at the very beginning, you know, how would you define the agrarian spirit? And then why do you think it matters in the moments that we're living in right now?
Yeah, wow, that's a great question, Philip. I think for me, the most important thing is that we need to find ways to calibrate our embodiment to all the things that make our embodied living potentially beautiful, nutritious, healthy. And that means we got to make these connections with land, with plants, with animals, with insects. And the way we do that best of all is through growing food, providing for our homes, right? Creating the energy sources we need to live. And all of that is stuff that people have done for millennia, right? We're so unusual in the history of humanity because we're among the first people to be able to shop for everything we need. And that means we don't have that kind of intimacy, that sort of practical engagement with the very natural sources of our livelihood. And I'm not faulting people for that. It's not that people wake up in the morning and say, how am I going to distance myself from the natural world? It's just the way that we've been raised when we're in urban environments. And so I think there's something deep about our embodiment that yearns to see the connections, to feel the connections, to smell the connections, right? It's a fully sensory kind of engagement. And what I want to do is I don't want to convince city people that they need to leave the city and become farmers. That's not what I'm about. But what I am interested in is helping people remember, like you're saying, that the fact that we are embodied means we depend upon all kinds of natural bodies. And as city people or as farming people or whatever, we have to understand and appreciate how those relationships work, how those relationships are vulnerable, and then also advocate for healing relationships that are broken, that are diseased, and finding ways that whether or not we're on a farm field or whether we're in a wilderness or a stream or wherever, that we're making the kinds of choices as citizens and as shoppers that will heal our world.
At the very beginning of the book, I want to say this might be in the very first few pages. You mentioned that this idea of being an agrarian or the agrarian spirit almost feels like it's out of step
right.
with the times that we're in. And you highlighted even just a few moments ago that we are the first humans collectively and very broadly that have the ability to shop for everything that we need. So I want to dive into that a little bit more, no pun intended, about
right.
what moved you, even with the recognition that the book might feel or the ideas might feel out of step, with also the what I would imagine is some urgency to actually put these ideas out into the world.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think a very important thing to say right up front is that even when you're in a city, you're not completely away from environmental, natural, created kinds of realities. We still breathe, we still drink, we still eat. All those things are constantly going on. And this is, I think, part of a beef that I have against environmentalism in the history of American context, particularly, because we've almost immediately associated any sort of environmental imagination with wilderness, right? National parks, you know, preserves. And those are places that were set up, historically speaking, for upwardly mobile, wealthy Americans, mostly white. Indigenous peoples were kicked off those lands. Those lands were not available to African-American people for the most part. And we're now at this juncture, which I'm really glad about, in which we're saying, let's start talking about environment so as to include cities, right? So we're talking about parks. We're talking about yards. We're talking about neighborhoods. We're talking about, you know, water systems that are, you know, in pipes. We're talking about all this stuff because everybody, even if you're in a city or if you're in a farm or whether you're in a wilderness campsite, you're still depending on the same things. And so we have to broaden the imagination to bring in these realities that are not typically in the sort of traditional environmental imagination, right? And so a book like Agrarian Spirit, which defines agrarian as person who cares about the health of land and people together, right? That becomes something that you don't have to be a farmer to care about the well-being of land. You can be a city person. But to do that well, you have to have some understanding about ecological realities. You got to understand something about the vulnerability of plant and animal life. You got to know things about, hey, it's really important we protect bees because if we don't have bees, we don't have pollinators, for instance. Doesn't mean you have to be a beekeeper. But it just means you got to say to politicians, you got to say to business leaders, stop doing the stuff that's killing bees. We need them, right? So that's the kind of imagination I'm trying to help cultivate in people, where they see that no matter where you are a deeply landed being that depends on all the creatures that are share the land with us.
And, you know, I think it's, as usual, you know, you made a lot of great points. And you know, I literally have written down in my notes, like in that out of step, the next kind of little arrow that goes down is, you know, how do cities fit into that? Which you started to answer it.
Yeah.
But I wanna continue down that line of thought a little bit because, you know, as a New Yorker, one of the things I've often cited is the type of imagination that went into, for example, creating a Central Park, you know, creating
right.
a Prospect Park in my home borough. And, you know, it's it's hard to think of that same commitment to taking literally acres of quote unquote prime real estate, right? The fact that we have these types of words that will distinguish land use as being one being more valuable than the other, right? So someone will look out on a field and say like, oh damn, that could be so many condos, right? Like why do we have all this empty space here doing absolutely nothing, right? And some of that mentality was what led us to colonization, exploitation, extraction, and genocide of indigenous people and others, right? So the seeing emptiness and feeling it as waste, right? Yep. And continue on with Central Park, you know, that at one point Central Park was a community of largely African Americans, those that were formerly enslaved or some relationship to that that were removed to make Central Park. So it's always like a bittersweet thing for me to go there and see this beautiful place that I do enjoy, but know that even that was sort of built on the backs and the removal of others. So long preamble to kind of speak to how in your mind, the connections, some of those natural connections that might exist to outdoor spaces has been somewhat broken or severed due to the way some of our urban areas are constructed, right? Yeah. Either there's social choices to putting parks in certain areas, not putting them in others, transportation accessibility to one versus the other. So I'm curious about how this agrarian spirit starts to fit into those types of policy reclamation.
Right, right. Oh my, those are such really important questions you're raising. So on the one hand, by helping each other remind ourselves about our embodiment and our need for contact with what we might call a larger than human world, I think so many people, especially coming through this period in COVID right now, where people are asking big questions about why have we been living the way that we have, and not just in terms of the ways of our patterns of being, but also the places of our being, right? So the fact that during COVID, it was really important for a lot of people to go on walks, to be outside, to be in nature, or think about whenever there's been sort of tragedy like September 11 in New York City, where did people go? They wanted to get out of the city. They wanted to be in nature, because people understand that being in natural spaces, being in gardens, being in forests, being by streams and creeks, having green space, there's something healing about being in the presence of these places. And I'm hoping that as we're doing this kind of evaluation, I hope we don't get to the place where we just think we have to get back to normal, because the previous normal was not so good for so many people, right? And especially as we're heading into a climate change reality where we know if we've got trees, if we've got parks, it makes a huge difference for people living in heat as compared to being just in a concrete spaces where the heat gets amplified because of concrete and glass and steel. So I think what we should be helping each other do as citizens, as urban residents, is talk to each other about the importance of cultivating these kinds of neighborhoods where there's green spaces, where there's opportunity for people to have community gardens, right? Or there's places for young people to, in their school curricula, get out into farm fields where they can see where their food comes from, maybe even participate in growing projects at the school. I mean, there's lots of ways, I think, for people to help each other reconnect with these fundamental plant, animal, soil creatures. And when we do that, there are so many health benefits. It's not just that, you know, you get to go for a walk in the park, but you get to participate in the growing of your own food, which tastes better than it's better for you than the, you know, highly processed stuff. And it creates, and this is, I think, not something to undersell, but it creates a kind of aesthetic appreciation for the world that we live in as being hospitable to our existence, right? When you're in a place that you know makes you feel better because it gives you fresh air or fragrant air, or it gives you fresh food, or it just gives you something pleasing to see and touch, you feel like you can belong in the world. But when you live in spaces that are just oppressive, you can tell that everything about the place is set up to suck your money away from you. It doesn't take much for you to start to feel that I'm here just to make sure somebody else gets rich. And if that's the kind of world you see yourself in over and over and over again, it's hard to believe that you matter as a human being. And so natural spaces can be really affirming. And, you know, one of the people that really helped me understand this was bell hooks. You know, her book, Belonging, which I think is just a wonderful, wonderful book. She says that one of the most important things she learned and actually helped precipitate her move from New York back to Kentucky was the need to connect to land. Because she says the land creates a sacred bond with people where they understand that the land cares for us. The land provides for us if we give it our care. And gardens are perfect examples of that. They're beautiful places and nutritious places and fragrant places and peaceful places often. And so people can come into those places and say, you know, this world isn't all bad because there's enough bad stuff that we create for each other through our political systems, economic systems. And so land becomes a deeply healing place for people.
I'm always going to be in favor of any mention of bell hooks.
Right.
So, you know, rest in peace to bell hooks. When we lost her at the end of last year, 2021, it was devastating.
Oh yeah.
You know, not just because of her scholarship, but just of, you know, I'm not going to go on a whole long tirade about bell hooks, but I came to bell hooks when I was in college, and the evolution of, I feel, her work very much dovetailed with my growth as a person. You know, you're 18 years old on a college campus is a lot different than reading her work at 30, 40 and beyond. So
right.
I'm always very touched by any bell hooks mention. And it gives us a perfect segue to kind of continue a little bit on that track, because as you're sharing these stories and thoughts around the land and the healing nature of land, there's also a duality or a separation very often in the American story of those who own and control the land,
right,
and those who work the land, you know, as a country whose growth and prominence grew out of chattel slavery for hundreds of years, and then de facto slavery after that with Jim Crow and sharecropping, you know, right. Thinking about Reconstruction, the promised but never delivered 40 acres and a mule, right? Part of that idea of putting the formerly enslaved on some sort of footing was connected deeply to land. Literally, it was 40 acres and a mule to work it, right?
Yep.
A promised, again, never delivered on. So again, long preamble, but I'm curious, when you think about that duality or that separable state of the ownership of land and those who work the land, and how there's a break there, like the land to some that have been forced to work it now becomes a source of trauma. How do we unpack some of that, even when, as you mentioned in the book, the resources toward, you know, Black farmers, you know, indigenous lands does not equal what goes to others,
right?
You know,
well, and you know, there's a really horrid example just recently, right, that the USDA had made an agreement to recompense African-American farmers who had been deprived of loans, who've had their lands confiscated for no good reason. And the promise was to make several billion dollars available in aid so they don't, you know, just come out of this debt that is so debilitating for farmers. And what happens? A bunch of white farmers say this is discrimination against white farmers because it's money that's earmarked just for African-American farmers. And I'm thinking, this is just insane that, you know, some white farmers can say, well, this is just going for Blacks, not for whites. And I'm thinking, but the history of the USDA has been all about it's for whites and not for Blacks. And nobody was saying, hey, let's make sure that Black farmers get their share. And so that this is an argument that could actually stall the payments of billions of dollars of relief that African-American farmers need right now, and that the history of African-American farming communities are deeply owed, right? This is just a horrid example about the continuing racism that we see infiltrating and affecting policies in the USDA. And I just listened recently that the USDA is trying to come up with a new plan in which they're going to make money available to address farmer indebtedness, because the rates of debt are pretty high still. But they've taken out the language which says we're going to especially focus on people of color and underrepresented groups. And so now the pool of money, which is a smaller pool, is open to all sorts of people. And again, who gets the raw end of the deal? It's African-American farmers, right? This is, first of all, I think, a story that needs to be told loud and clear, so that when white farmers who have been getting all the benefits for so long, when they say things like this is discriminatory, they need to understand just how hypocritical and how awful it is to even suggest something like that. And then citizens, and again, this is the important thing, that, you know, even urban folk who are not farmers, citizens can say to their elected officials, this has to be a priority in the USDA, that money has to be made available to people who have been historically excluded from all the resources, the training, the financial help that everybody else, white farmers, have gotten for decades. And then there, I think there just has to also be the work of reparations. And this is really touchy, because I know that there are plenty of folk who say, we're not going to give up land, even though if you do the history, you discover that they just appropriated lands from African-Americans left and right. And we have to then be able to say, okay, how does the government, how do communities come together to give land back to African-American communities? And here again, I want to invoke bell hooks, because she says that one of the really tragic results of the Great Migration is that people, African-American people in particular, who at least had some stability because they were on land where they could grow their own food, where they had this spiritual connection with the land, sensed their own value as being members of the land. When they made that Great Migration, they lost access to the land. They lost the kind of self-sufficiency to grow their own food, and they became completely subservient to the white bosses and industry. And she says that's been deeply damaging. And she says what we need to do is find ways to get people back on the land. And I know this is a hard, hard sell, because the price of land now has just exploded everywhere across the country. And so it's going to take regulations. It's going to take government decisions which say we're going to have to find ways to do the reparation work of getting hands or the land back in the hands of the people who lost it generations ago, or in some instances, just decades ago. That has to be a priority that a general population advocates for. And that ain't going to happen until people become educated about the history of agriculture in this country.
You know, this what you just said really sparked me to jump to the bottom of my questions. So I'm leaping around a little bit here.
All right.
But, you know, because you mentioned community and the importance of community. And that's woven throughout the book, this idea of,
yeah,
of building. I think in one portion is referred to as, like, we need to think of this as a mesh, how we right. are meshed together as living beings. And so yeah. My question, or my provocation, is, given the importance of that in the agrarian spirit, how do we start to think about the models that we're using to make this actually come to fruition,
right?
That's different from the traditional ownership model, right? Because in some way, ownership and by extension, ownership extends into capitalism,
right?
It makes all the things that we're kind of talking about, right? It makes borders, it makes yep. owners and workers, it makes all of these relationships that now become part of that older system, right? Like, how do we start to think about confronting that in a different way? And I don't even know if there's an answer we're going to hash out in this moment, but just that it really jumped out at me, and then the community yeah. piece kind of cemented it. So I wanted to get to that.
Right, right. So I think, you know, this sounds like it's a cheap answer, but it's not. I think we start with awareness. I think we have to, first of all, name what has happened, which is that in the last several decades, under especially the inspiration of people like Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, we've got this thing called neoliberalism, which becomes not just a dominant sort of political philosophy, but it becomes an economic philosophy. It becomes a philosophy that guides the way we build our cities and our neighborhoods and our houses and our transportation networks, all that sort of stuff. And what is neoliberalism all about? It's about everything falls on the individual. If you make it, it's because you did it. If you failed, it's because of your problems. It's not the system that you need to attend to. It's not the structures. It's not communities. And in a way, you can make the argument that this neoliberal emphasis was preceded in capitalism by the kinds of financial institutions, insurance companies, whatever, that really tried to take community out of the equation, right? So you got to make it on your own. And this becomes, of course, deeply embedded in the American myth about the self-made individual. And I think what we need to do is we need to say, hold on a sec here. This idea isn't even true to our own experience, right? It's not honest about our own living, because if we are careful to sort of speak to each other in ways that acknowledge how we've been benefited all along the way by, first of all, parents, by the assistance of teachers and hospitals and public libraries and, right, and all this thing, then we begin to understand how our existence is never an individual success or failure story. It's a community success or failure story. And this is really hard for a lot of people to hear. I mean, remember when Obama not so long ago, you know, said something about how, wait a minute, the idea that Jeff Bezos got rich because of his own ingenuity. Come on, that's ridiculous. This whole libertarian notion just falsifies way too much of our own experience. So I think we start with naming how we've become captive to a neoliberal ideology, and then helping people appreciate how it's just not true to what we know about our own development historically. That at least opens the door, I hope, to people realizing, you know, we really need to take care of public schools. We need to tend to public health concerns. We need to think about, you know, food systems, because all of these systems that we're a part of can either do the job of helping communities flourish or helping communities decline. And what we're seeing is a lot of communities that are declining, and they're declining because they're being abandoned. They're not getting the resources they need. And where are those resources going to instead? People who've got a lot of power, people who've got a lot of money, and they're just getting richer and more powerful. And so, not surprisingly, we're getting more and more economists who are saying it's wealth inequality, which is becoming one of the major problems for the future of American society.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That concentration, that obscene concentration.
Oh, it's obscene. Absolutely. You got to name it as that, right?
It's choking us all, right?
Like, oh, yeah.
In one way or another. You know, I want to get into sort of the faith aspects that, again, is so woven into and so much a part of the book. I mean, literally the subtitle, Cultivating Faith, Community, and the Land. Right.
Yeah.
And again, I'm reading through the book and I'm thinking about those separable states, right? Those moments of separation. And I'm a layman, so excuse me if I'm simplifying a lot of stuff, but there is, I think, in, let's call it layman's Christianity, right? For lack of a better word.
Sure.
This idea that, you know, God kind of created all of this, gave man dominion over the birds and the, you know, paraphrasing again, because I'm not expert, the birds and the creatures and everything.
And the birds and the bees,
right? but I have seen, particularly in that sort of evangelical world, where there is that notion quite simply like, hey, we control all of this.
Yep.
So we can do whatever we want. If it runs out, that's part of the plan. If it doesn't, that's part of the plan too, right? So it's a very slippery, logical argument to combat. But the reason why I reference it is that the faith that you describe within the book is markedly different from that faith story. Mm-hmm. So in your role and as a scholarly role and as a person of faith, how do you not combat, because that's not the right word that I want to use, but how do you start to integrate this faith story against a faith story that seems to make a counter narrative for doing more of the same? Whereas this seems like a faith argument for doing things radically different.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think it has to be something that when you're in conversation is going to be different depending on who you're talking to, right? So if you're talking to someone who's a very, say, conservative evangelical who reads the Bible in a very literal way, you're going to say, okay, you read Genesis very literally, where it says subdue and have dominion. Why don't you read Jesus very literally about what to do with your wealth, right? You can't just pick and choose what's going to be literal and what's not going to be literal. And so what you're doing in a way is you're opening the Bible with them and saying, let's read different parts of the Bible and let's see if the case that you want to make is sustained throughout. And I think what you'll discover pretty quickly is that the people who love to quote Genesis 1, 26 to 28, this subdue and have dominion passage, that's about all they want to quote from the Bible, right? They want to just leave the rest out, because the rest is, you know, you got the prophets in there who are talking about taking care of the poor, making sure that there's nobody hungry, right? Nobody hungry. Imagine a world where nobody was hungry, right? Where there were no orphans who were abandoned, right? No widows who were abandoned, right? That's incredible. That would already require a completely different economic system than the one that gets trumpeted out for subdue and have dominion, right? And so you have to sort of use scripture to actually work against the kinds of arguments that are doing so much damage. And then, you know, if you want to get more sophisticated with people, is you start to talk about, well, how has this passage been interpreted in other times, other periods? And what you discover pretty soon is that this idea of subdue and have dominion, in the sense that we now like to or often hear it said, where it means human beings can do with the world whatever they want, that idea didn't become prominent until the Industrial Revolution, right? Where we developed the technological, mechanical means to actually take control of the world. Because if you're a farmer, if you're a shepherd, if you run a vineyard, you know you can't just do with plants and animals whatever you want. You can do whatever you want with machines, but you can't do that with living things, because when you don't respect the life of plants and animals, you destroy the life of plants and animals. And if you're a farmer or a shepherd, if you destroy the life that you're trying to cultivate, that's just stupid. And so from an agrarian point of view, subduing and having dominion could never mean that you can just abuse or exploit or extract from the world without end, because that would undermine your own livelihood. So that's another approach. And then the third one that I like to emphasize, and it's why I started Agrarian Spirit the way that I did, is we start with this idea that God creates the world out of love. Okay, so when you ask, why does God make a world at all? The best answer that theologians have been able to come up with is that God creates because God loves for something other than God to exist. Now, if every body, literally plant, animal, human, insect, soil, body, exists only because God loves it into existence, you think God wants to see any of it abused, any of it destroyed? That just goes counterintuitive to what we understand love to do. It would be like saying to a parent, you've just created this beautiful child. You've given all your attention to making sure this child can flourish in the best specific ways that are unique to that child. Now you really want to see this child suffer? You really want to see this child done in? Or if you're an artist and you've worked for a long time to make a beautiful work of art, a painting, piece of music, do you want to see someone come along and just mess it up or destroy it? Right? Love does not want to see what it loves destroyed. It wants to see what it loves flourish. And that's sort of the bedrock assumption that I want to develop in Agrarian Spirit. And we see that way of thinking develop throughout the whole of Scripture, Old Testament and New Testament. We're being taught repeatedly how to love better and how to be on the lookout for the forces, the behaviors that destroy what love loves.
Absolutely. And love is another primary idea, right? And so in that vein, kind of going down kind of the love tunnel a little bit longer.
It's a good place to be.
It's a great place to be, man. It's love as public policy, as I like to say.
Yeah.
How do we incorporate this notion of love into a practice and a process that includes cultivation? You know, that word came up a lot in the book, of cultivating something, of creating something in a practical sense. Yeah. So I want to give you the opportunity to kind of connect the process and the reality of love as you've described it into a practice and a process of cultivation.
Yeah, that's a really important question, because the danger is that when we talk about love, we're just going to get sentimental, right, or romantic, and not really be attending to the very important practical, and I will stress economic, aspects of love. And so for people who are in urban contexts where they're not actually cultivating a field or a vineyard or a pasture or whatever, I think one of the best ways for us to start, and everybody's going to have their own starting point and sort of approach that's best for them given their situation. I think food is a great way, because everybody eats. I know we have different relationships to the food that we do eat, but one of the things that we can do when we're shopping for our food is we can ask something about the history of how this food came to be, right? So when we go and we look at a fast food chain that's selling, you know, meat for like 99 cents, or it's got vegetables that they look pretty nasty, they don't have any flavor in them, and you know, we're eating bread that
vegetables might be a stretch.
Yeah, right, exactly. It doesn't take long when you investigate the history to see that these are foods that have been created without love, right? They've been raised in factories more than they've been raised on land, you know, cared for by farmers or gardeners. And so what I recommend to people is you can't change your whole shopping basket at one go, but you can start to advocate for buying food that honors eaters like you, so the food is nutritious, but it honors the farmers who grow the food, right? And that's a hard sell, I know, because there are places in the country where it's really hard to find food where you can know anything about the history of how it came to be. But this too is a citizen issue, where as citizens, we can vote to have agricultural policy that supports farmers who actually care for animals, who care about soil health, who care about clean water, who care about not using poisons unnecessarily, because our foods are saturated with poison. So that becomes something where, again, it's not all on the individual to fix the whole system. But when citizens come together and say, we want to have a food system that honors eaters, that honors animals, honors farmers, honors the land, that can put in motion the kind of cultivation, right? Because on the one hand, you're not just cultivating your own diet, but you're cultivating the next generation of farmers who want to do the right thing when they raise animals, when they raise food for us to eat. And I don't want to minimize the role that faith communities can play here, because faith communities are big voting blocks, and they have all the reason in the world to think about food as a precious gift rather than just an exploitable commodity. So if faith people can become aware of how precious food is, because it's a gift from God, and that we need to cherish eaters and we need to cherish producers, that might help get things going in a better direction.
Absolutely. And it that brings me to another example that you talk about in the book, this idea of gardening. And I interpreted it as not just the physical ability to have a garden, even though gardening is growing at exponential rates, even within urban areas,
right?
Rooftop gardening, vertical gardening, like there's,
right,
you know, we're finding a way, even in these concrete canyons, to make it happen. But I also viewed gardening as a metaphor for the type of care and cultivation that one needs in order to build something long-lasting. There's another guest that we've had on the show also more than one time. Her name is Anne Stenros. And in our conversation with her, my most recent conversation with her, she talked a lot about a leadership model in organizations that would more replicate that of a gardener. So when I was reading your work, I started to think back to conversations I've had with her, both officially on the show and privately. And I wanted to get your thoughts more in the gardening realm. Because I think you made a really interesting point in the book where you talked about the work of gardening and a higher level or, you know, a different level farming is normally builds in failure. and uncertainty and how we've tried to move away from that. And it just clicked that that's such a interesting way to metaphor out into lots of other spaces. So I kind of wanted to give you an opportunity to kind of talk and reflect more on that notion of gardening, particularly as it pertains to failure and uncertainty. Two things organizations don't like.
Hey, for sure. I mean, and personally, we don't like it. I mean, this is why if you do actual gardening, you learn very quickly that you don't have control. You learn very quickly that you have impotence and ignorance. You can't just make things happen because of your will, and you can't always understand why is this happening? I didn't want this to happen. And we need to be aware of our ignorance, of our impotence, of our impatience with things, because plants, they have their own lives and they're always vulnerable. Now, take that to this next stage about being with people. Why do we think it's any different if we're going to care for plants and we realize how we're often impotent, ignorant, impatient? We're the same with people, right? People are also vulnerable. They have their own schedules, their own potential, their own growth rates, if you want to put it that way. And we have to learn to be patient. We have to learn to be committed, to stick with them. We have to learn how to protect them, how to cherish them, and how to enjoy them, right? And these are all skills that fall within the kind of what we might call the toolkit or the skill set of gardening, right? Gardening is that exercise that when you exercise proper care, proper attention, bring the right kinds of skill to the situation, you get lucky and you have really delicious food or really beautiful flowers. And it's the same with people. If you've got attention, if you're patient, if you remain committed to them, even in the midst of their struggle, if you're lucky, you'll get a beautiful relationship. You'll get a person who's just thriving to the max. But when we don't do the kind of attention, the patience and such, we don't bring the skill set of love to the relationship, people languish, they suffer. And we see this, right? I mean, one of my daughters, she's a fourth grade school teacher, and it just breaks her heart to see kids that are not being gardened by their parents. They're not being nurtured. They're not being watered. They're not being protected. They're not being cherished. And these kids are growing up, and they're just not going to be able to even understand their potential, let alone realize their potential. And that's what we want to see happen with kids. And so that means parents have to figure out how they're going to garden really well.
And, you know, even in that gardening analogy, to kind of go in one other direction here, the notion of being in a particular place, the physical location of gardening or farming denotes a sort of stationary moment in time. But I think in the spirit, in the agrarian spirit, when you're talking about knowing and being in a place, it takes on a different connotation, a different meaning. And I want to give you an opportunity to kind of talk a little bit about that notion of place and how it connects to the agrarian spirit.
Oh, yeah, that's such a great question. Because when you're farming or when you're gardening, you start by attending to the place. You got to figure out what's here, what's the history of what's gone on here before, so that I know, am I trying to garden on topsoil that's been completely eroded? Or am I trying to garden in a place that's become a toxic site and it would be really dangerous to grow food here? Right? You got to pay attention to the place. And I want to say the agrarian impetus is to also say that about communities. If you're going to try to do work in a community, you got to find out what kind of community is it? What's the history of what's gone on here before? Is there a toxic history here? Are there wounds that have never been addressed or wounds that have never even been named? And when that's going on, it's really hard for us to do the work that contributes to mutual flourishing, because we keep sidestepping the history that keeps coming into our faces and saying, you haven't yet addressed this issue. You haven't repented of this. You haven't asked for forgiveness. You haven't tried to do the work that really builds mutual understanding and mutual sympathy. And so the agrarian position always asks, pay attention to where you are. Know what's been going on where you are. Know what the limits are of what you can do where you are, and also what the possibilities are of what you can do where you are. And that means we got to talk about social, but also ecological context at the same time.
Yeah, the ecological, the mesh, right? I mentioned that a little earlier. And, you know, I'm keeping an eye on the time, because I promise you it would be an hour or so, right? But I do want to spend a little bit of time on that meshing notion, because I think it starts to speak to an equalizing of our connections as human beings, as being part of these natural systems. It starts to disabuse us of our ideas of hierarchy.
Yeah.
And it puts us into a place where it's a deeper sort of connection, right? Like we do realize that we need one another. So all of this might sound contrary to the way in which the world might feel, right? But this is why we're here. Right. To kind of maybe bridge that gap. So, you know, talk to me about that meshing that again is woven throughout the book and seems to me as a recent reader bridges gaps, even if, like you said, city to more rural, you know, those who have a traditional faith tradition to those who might not have any faith tradition or have a different faith tradition, community, all of our communities look different. So how do we weave all that together in that idea of meshing? And then I'll get to the final two segments of the show.
Sure. So, I mean, the basic insight behind this meshwork idea that I've got going in the book is that we've been misled, we've been dishonest when we think of ourselves as individuals. And you know, there's reasons why we do that. We think that because we got skin, that we've got these very discrete borders that identify us as being separate from other kinds of things that are out there. But we are never bounded, closed off kinds of realities that exist by ourselves. And we know this because try plugging your nostrils and see how long you last, or don't open your mouth, right? Don't drink, don't eat, see how long you last. Right? Our belly buttons are already everyday reminders of the fact that we were born with an umbilical cord that tied us intimately, I mean, super intimately to our mothers, right? These are all things that tell us we've never been alone. We've always depended on others. And I think what's exciting is to know that we've got some recent science that is helping us appreciate that most of the genetic material in our bodies isn't even our own, because of this thing called the microbiome, right? Our bodies are, especially in our gastrointestinal systems, are hosts to billions, right? Billions of microorganisms that we absolutely need, because without them, we wouldn't be able to digest food. We wouldn't be able to fend off diseases. We wouldn't be able to develop in all the sort of physiological ways that we need to develop. Right? These microorganisms are absolutely crucial to who we are and how we grow and develop and take care of ourselves. So what this means is that we're not just people who can choose to be in relationship with others. We are already always constituted by our relationships. And so the question then is not, will we be in relationship, but what are we going to do with the relationships we in fact depend on? How are we going to honor or dishonor those relationships? Are we going to do the things that strengthen the relationships or fracture, right? Or disentangle the relationships that we need? That's the kind of stuff that meshwork thinking does, is it helps us realize that individualism it's not just dangerous and destructive, it's deeply untrue. And when we understand that we are our relationships, then we can start to ask the really important questions about, well, what kinds of relationships are we not paying enough attention to? What kinds of relationships are really strong and we can focus on others? Which ones really need attention because they're languishing or they're hungry or they're sick or whatever? That becomes the fundamental work. And that means, how do you activate the love that builds relationships?
Absolutely, man. Deep, deep mesh work. That's what we need, man. we are already made up of relationships. And it's absolutely true. You know, the more I read and learn about these things, the more I you can't state that enough. And to the extent that we do state it, we're still managing to understate it because of how intricate and complex and deep all of these relationships truly are.
Yeah. And I think it's important then as educators, as thinkers, as writers, that we keep bringing it up for people, because the messaging in so many other sectors of our lives is, you know, you're an individual.
Yeah.
You either make it on your own or you fail on your own. And that's just so untrue. And it's just so damaging to people.
Yeah, absolutely. It has a lot of, it builds in a lot of isolation, a lot of loneliness. You know, I'm not going to get on a whole other show, but it does. But you know, these you know, we have a real crisis around these things, right?
Right.
People feeling like, you know, we're more connected and less connected, right? There's this cliche that people have all these connections, but yet they feel lonely and out of sorts.
Yeah.
And, you know, they yearn for, I think, that mesh, and maybe they don't know how to get it.
Well, they do. And I think, yeah. And I think what you're pointing to is that there's a difference between being included and feeling you belong.
Yeah.
You can be included and still be lonely.
Oh, yeah.
But if you belong, then it's not lonely.
Yeah.
Because you recognize that people need you and they want you, and you need them too.
Absolutely. You know, we're both, you know, you're at Duke right now. I'm a Duke graduate. And, you know, we had that volleyball incident, right? Other day, right? Like,
yeah,
they left that student alone on that court.
Oh, I know.
To deal with that. And I think minute you said that, it made me think about that, right?
Well, and the guy shouting the word, they figured he's just a loan agent, right? And you're thinking, no, you're responsible for this guy. He's part of you.
Yeah, he's a part of your community.
He represents you. You're part of that community. So as a community, you got to do something about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we think too much in terms of, well, just everybody for themselves. And that's not the way life is, or at least that's not the way life is at its best.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So with that poignant note, you know, we're going to get to Off the Dome, which are just a couple of rapid fire questions. First thing that comes to the top of your head, right? So
all right.
My first one sounds kind of deep, but it doesn't have to be overly deep. I was thinking about practical skills and that inspired me. So I was like, what's the last thing you did that you're really proud of?
Oh, I built a kitchen table and 6 chairs.
You're a wizard. How'd you do that?
Oh man, I had so much fun doing it. It was the best.
As someone who can't do any of that, dude, you are like a grand maester. I'm like,
oh man, I used to do construction. That's why I know how to do that stuff.
Anytime you're coming up to Brooklyn and you feel like getting your hands on some stuff, I got more than enough you can do.
All right.
And my last one, which is just quick, we just have 2 this time around. And maybe one is a little inspired by a show I've been watching that I mentioned a little earlier today, but I won't mention it again because these things are out of sequence. I don't know when they're all going to be hearing, listening to them. If you had an opportunity to either go to the Olympics or go to space, which one would you choose and why?
Oh, Olympics. Olympics. I love watching athletes perform. It's just, it's poetry in motion. It's just beautiful to see what people can do.
Absolutely. Yeah. Space is scary, right? I'm like,
yeah,
I want to stay tethered to the earth.
We don't belong out there. We can go out there to visit, but we don't belong there.
Yeah, I'm trying to stay right here. I want to make this marble better, right? I'll worry about the other marbles later. So we just had 2 off the dome, and I want to get to the drop. And the drop is an opportunity for us to share anything with our listeners at all. I have 2, which are books this time around. The first one is called The Wizard of Oz and Other Narcissists. And the other one is called Adult Children of Emotionally Immature Parents, which are both books unrelated to one another somewhat, but I found them online. I'm a big Twitter user, and different people mentioned them. Two completely different people mentioned these books in threads, and just the threads that they wrote about seemed really interesting to me.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, I want to read those books, even though I wrestle with a lot of therapy language, not because I'm against therapy, but I feel like another thesis, right? That therapy has become one of these things that kind of puts us in the individual, you know? So I've been thinking a lot about how we've kind of used that language to kind of be like, I'm okay, you're okay. Like, we don't need to look at big systems, just go to therapy and everything will be fine, right? So that made me want to read the book. So convoluted, but again, Adult Children of Emotionally Immature Parents, and that's by Lindsay Gibson. And then the other one is The Wizard of Oz and Other Narcissists, and that's by Eleanor D. Payson. And so those are my drops for this week or this episode.
All right. Yeah. So mine is a poem that one of my students actually sent me today.
Oh, awesome.
And I'm a big fan of Mary Oliver, a lot of her poetry. But this is a poem I didn't know before, and I thought I'd read it to people. It's called Don't Hesitate. And the poem goes like this. If you suddenly and unexpectedly feel joy, don't hesitate. Give in to it. There are plenty of lives and whole towns destroyed or about to be. We are not wise and not very often kind, and much can never be redeemed. Still, life has some possibility left. Perhaps this is the way it's fighting back, that sometimes something happens better than all the riches or power in the world. Could be anything. But very likely you notice it in the instant when love begins. Anyway, that's often the case. Anyway, whatever it is, don't be afraid of its plenty. Joy is not made to be a crumb.
I love that.
I love it too. That's why I thought I had to read it.
That's awesome.
It's a good one.
That is a really, really good one. Don't hesitate.
Yeah.
Right on, man. This has been, you know, Norman, is always a pleasure to have you on the show. I appreciate your work. I appreciate you sharing. I appreciate your soothing dulcet tones.
Well, I love talking with you, Philip. This has been great.
So thanks again for being on the deep dive with me. I appreciate you.
Oh, thank you so much.
You can listen to The Deep Dive via Apple Podcasts and our website, thedeepdivepod.com. Download, subscribe, listen, and share. If you like what you're hearing and enjoy what me and the team are putting together, then leave us a review. We'd love to hear from you. You can follow me on Twitter via @farflungphil. To all my listeners, wherever you are in the world, I thank you. See you on the other side.